Hi there, I'm Jake Humphrey and you're listening to High Performance, our conversation for you every single week. This is the podcast that reminds you that it's within your ambition, your purpose, your story. It's all there. We just help you unlock it by turning the lived experiences of the planet's highest performers into your life lessons. And in a moment, you'll hear a conversation with myself and Professor Damien Hughes speaking to a great leader. And as you know, in the last few days, we have lost a great leader, Her Royal Highness Queen Elizabeth II. And the reason why she was a great leader is because she was a great follower. The very best leaders have a North Star, have principles, have guiding lights which they follow. Now, for Queen Elizabeth, that guiding light was religion. And it doesn't have to be religion, and it doesn't have to be faith. But all great leaders do need something. Something they truly believe in, something that guides their every decision. And I wanted to share with you a reading that the Queen shared over 20 years ago, because I think it speaks to the power of high performance.
Go forth into the world in peace. Be of good courage. Hold fast that which is good. Render to no man evil for evil. Strengthen the faint-hearted. Support the weak. Help the afflicted, honour all men.
So the Queen talks there about peace, about courage, strengthening others, honouring everybody. And that's exactly what we aim to do here on the High Performance Podcast. We want you to get peace and courage from these episodes. We want to support you in your own journey towards high performance, and we want to strengthen you as you walk forwards. So this episode, which is dedicated to the memory of Her Royal Highness Queen Elizabeth II, is a conversation with a leader, and you'll hear a conversation with a leader who also has a guiding light behind him. Here's what to expect on today's episode of the High Performance Podcast.
When I came second, my father didn't talk to me for the week because he said, "You put shame on the family name." I was just going to retire, just had retired when I got the call from Doralton. For me, I would not have taken any other job in the world. I said, "This is your team. All the people work for you. And you have to make sure that they love you, that they want to work for you, that they give the very best for you, that they work very hard for you, and that they are happy and proud if you win, because they work for you. They don't work for me, they work for you."
So welcome to our fourth High Performance Podcast episode with a leader in Formula One. We've spoken with the Mercedes boss, Toto Wolff, Red Bull's Christian Horner, Zak Brown from McLaren just a few weeks ago. And now we're joined by the CEO and team principal of the Williams Formula One team, Jost Capito, a German leader who has been involved in motorsport for many years. And I actually found this a really, really wonderful episode to record. I think that we are so obsessed with people being loud and brash and using words to tell you what they want you to think. But there's that old phrase, isn't there? "I can't believe what you say because I can see what you do." And I think the magic about Jost that you're going to hear in the next hour is that he chooses his words carefully, and you absolutely buy into and believe what he's saying because his actions back up what he says. He will talk about his upbringing. I mean, he shares with us the most remarkable story from his father and how it shaped him and how it inspired him to do what he does today. But he also shares what it was like turning up at Williams during a pandemic, trying to turn around a team who were used to losing, changing that mindset, dealing with people that didn't come on the journey, protecting one of his drivers when he was getting death threats after being at the center of the way that the Formula One season ended back in 2021. And it's great to hear him talking that way. I also love the phrase, "Words are free. It's how you use them that may cost you." And this is a man who has incredible integrity. He chooses his words carefully, but the words that he delivers, I know, will be really beneficial to you. It was a pleasure to go to the amazing, historic Williams Formula One factory and speak to a man who is totally honoured by the fact that he is in charge of that famous old Formula One team. So our latest episode with a team principal from Formula One comes next. Welcome to the High Performance Podcast, Jost Capito.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Let's start as we always do. What, in your mind, represents high performance?
Oh, you start with a difficult question. So, you know, high performance is can have in various areas. All my career I was involved in high performance cars, and that's what I always wanted to do. When you define what a high performance car is, it needs to be high power output, fuel efficient, a sporty chassis, good handling, good brakes. So I think that that shows that high performance is not one attitude. You know, high performance is every attitude on the product or on the project you want to achieve. So it's very difficult to explain. For the car, I think it's much easier to explain than you have high performance humans. I think that's also very complex. It is dedication. It is loyalty. You have to make your objective your living if you want to be really high performing. And then it's again high performance team that is then again more complex. Just a couple of high performing people don't necessarily become a high performing team, isn't it? Because the dynamics within the team has to be right. So you have to get the right people together to create a high performing team. It's not just get the biggest high performers, put them together and then having a high performing team. I think that that's never the case.
And to say getting the right people together to create a high performance team is easy. Doing it is very difficult. We're talking to you here in the beautiful experience center at Williams, and you just look around here to see the history of this incredible team, and you came in at a time when Williams was struggling, things were very difficult, and your job was to find high performance within this team. So can we go right back to the day that you walked in the doors of the Williams Formula One team? And I guess the first thing is, how did you decide to work out what was here to see the truth of this team?
You know, I started in February last year. That was the COVID time, so I couldn't even come here. So I had to start from home in Germany. And I think if you get into a company that's 800 employees and you can't introduce yourself in person, you can only do it through Teams or through Teams especially, or through radio, through telephone. It's a complete different situation. And as I knew that was going to happen, I prepared myself and say, how should I do this? And I read a couple of books and got some information from the internet. Have people done that before? What is important? I found on one book that a guy who came in as new CEO did questions to the management. And I thought, this is quite a good idea. We have about 80 managers and directors, managers. So having the same questions to all of them in a half an hour session. So that's what I did. We had a town hall where everybody could dial in. And then I scheduled the meetings with every manager for half an hour and sent them the questions up front.
And what were they?
I think there were five questions. What would you like to change? Or what has to be changed? What has not to change? What would you like to change? What advice would you give me? And what would you advise me not to do? So those were the five questions to every single manager. And some said, okay, yeah, I sent you the file, I wrote it down. And they said, no, I want a discussion. I just don't want to read the answers. I want a discussion, so don't send me anything. And that was really exciting.
And why was that important for you to have the discussion rather than see it written?
Because if you see something written, you don't know really what is the real meaning behind it, isn't it? And if you have a discussion, you can ask the questions, and then you get much more out of out of it than just reading something. So even if they had prepared it, they had to tell me and not sending me to read it. So that, for me, it's important to, you know, in the voice you hear also what you hear more than when somebody tells you something than you read the words, because you get more emotions, you get more feeling. What does the person think about it? What does he feel when he says that?
And out of those five questions, Jos, which one gave you the most revealing answers?
I think all, but then you could see when I clustered the answers and it came up that, so what do you want to have to change or what should be changed? You see, you came up to four or five things that always got repeated when you say what should be not changed. And it was very much what not should be changed is the name Williams. The heritage should be important, should not be forgotten. And the family feel of the company. So that was, I think, 80% said these three. So then I got the feeling what's really important. And when you see three, four things that 80% think that should be changed, it's pretty clear that those are the things that should be changed. And then you have to set the priorities. And with that, I could easily set the priorities, what has to be made clear that is not changing. So coming then in the team and say, look, it's very clear, the name will stay. We'll keep the museum. The heritage is important for us. Yeah. And the way you work and the family feeling we have as a family run business, this will stay. So that gave then the whole team the confidence that there is consistency, a continuity, and that they can continue feeling the way they feel.
And what was the overarching message for what needed to change?
The overarching message for me to change is to create processes, improve processes, and to increase the efficiency. And also the getting rid of silos, yeah, to increase the cooperation within the different areas. That was the main thing that was said that has to change, and I would say this is the hardest thing to change. That comes then, was the overarching meaning was that needs a culture change.
But I'm surprised you mentioned the silos when people had told you that family dynamic was very evident. How do you feel that silos had developed even when you had that kind of family dynamic in the wider business?
It's a very good question, and you have to see how that comes. I think when you have a family business that is quite small, then it is quite easy. The communication is pretty simple. Yeah, because everybody knows everybody, everybody talks to everybody. When you get to a certain size, this is not working anymore. And if you continue like this kind of communication, then a lot of things get lost. And then the communication gets split into various areas. So you have a communication in design, you have a communication in the shop floor, you have a communication somewhere else, and they are not necessarily the same.
Right.
Yeah. So to get the same thing again, you need to lots of communication to everybody and in the same way, so that you get the same feeling back again. But that needs systems to do that, and it needs a process to do this. And that's what we established.
And this is very helpful for people that listen to this who are business leaders, but also, you know, parents, making sure they communicate better with their kids, or teachers, lots of teachers listen to the High Performance Podcast as well. So you've had this message loud and clear from this place that people are working in silos, the processes and the communication is not good enough. Then you finally get a chance to come here to Wantage to meet the team. How do you practically go about making these changes?
Yeah, the first thing is, again, when I came, it was all COVID and nearly everybody was working from home. Then I was here, but nobody else was here, really. So that didn't make it easy. But we established town halls after every race. So every Monday, Tuesday after a race, we set up the teams meetings where everybody could dial in. And so we got the information about what happened in the race, and what also to discuss what has to be done for the next race. And it's not just a race team, isn't it? We got 50, 60 people going to races, but we've overall 800 people. So it's the vast majority is staying home and working at home, and they have to identify themselves with what's going on the racetrack, because that's finally the delivery of what everybody does. So that's communication. Then it needs a lot of communication also also from HR what's going on. And it also needs for me to walk around. Yeah. And I say the engineering office was really empty at that time because everybody working from home, but the shop floor was busy because you can't produce the parts from home. So I think that was quite important to get to be seen and to have an open door policy. What I did before I arrived, I said, I don't want to sit in an office. So I have never been here. I say, take the walls off. I want to sit with the assistant, with the secretary in one area. And I want the sofa there and I want the TV there and I want it to be like a living area. And as I always like to have an open door policy. So we even took the doors off. So there is no barrier to come and see me.
It's a literal open door. So one of our previous guests was Toto Wolff, who told us that he encountered a little bit of cynicism from the shop floor when he first came, of people that said, I've heard all these grand visions and great words in the past, but I'll judge you on your actions. And he said that was a really good reminder to him that it was actually about delivery rather than just talking a good game. When you would have this open door policy here in Williams, have you ever received any sort of direct feedback from the shop floor that you've been able to take on board and implement?
There was quite a hesitation for people to come to see me in my office. I think it's quite a big step to go in the second floor and go to see me. I had a good experience with KIP level meetings in the past. When I worked at Ford, that was a must for every manager to have that, I think, once a year, twice a year. And I found it that helpful that I always did it with every job I had thereafter. So in the KIP level meetings is that everybody can apply to see me.
So just explain the origins of that term skip level. So you go to the level above your boss.
Yeah, so everybody can.
So it's any level you want?
Any level. Anybody who wants to talk to me, wants to see me, can go in these meetings, right. Can apply. And this is much easier than just go up there and ask for a one-to-one, isn't it? So, and in those meetings, I think they are really excellent because then we have 10, 15 people and we have 1.5 hours and we talk about everything
Brilliant.
People are bothered want to know. And this is not just for me to get the information. It's also for me to give information that I see what people, what my colleagues are bothered about, what they want to know, what they're worried about. Yeah, that it's very useful. But also the interaction, if you have from all various departments and you have all different levels, you have managers, you have a guy from the shop floor, you have a cleaner. They have never met each other. Yeah, they don't know what they work. They don't understand what is the issues of another department. And then you very often find, we have the same issue. Or, we had this issue. We found a solution. And this interaction in these KIP level meetings is fantastic. So those are the meetings I appreciate most. And I think they are really excellent also to get the silos down because the people know each other. They get to know each other, understand other people have also issues. It's not just only I myself have issues, it's everybody. And I take these issues then in a management committee and it's all then anonymous. I don't say who said what, but then we discuss these issues in a management committee and decide solutions. So, and that gives then the feedback, then gives the employee and say, yeah, you know, I went in that meeting that and something has been done. Yeah, it's not everything can be solved immediately, but I think a fair amount.
So I can see how that fits within that earlier phrase you used around you had to change the culture here when you came in. But I've also read the comment that you made that the culture seemed to be almost like downbeaten by the performances. And again, one of our previous guests was Paul McGinley, the Ryder Cup captain for Europe in the golf, where he'd spoken about some advice Alex Ferguson, the football coach, had given him about you always want to be the hunter, not the hunted. And it sounds like when you inherited it, it was a culture of feeling that you were being hunted. So how have you gone about addressing that mentality shift?
You know, we have to see that in the years before the Williams family sold the team, they had difficult times on the financial side, on the sponsor side. So there was not a huge amount to invest and to take the team forward. It was very much in survival mode. And with that survival mode, when you see the other teams invest and move on, then if you can't do it, you feel like, yeah, of course we can't be competitive because we can't do this, we can't do that. And then you get to a feeling the team says, okay, it's fine. We are good where we are. Yeah. And if you are then a couple of years really last, it is, you know, okay, as long as we were there, this is good enough. It's fine. We are part of that and this is fine. But then to get this back and say, we can do better. But it's not that easy either, because we have the gap to the bigger teams. Yeah, they had done the investment. We haven't done the investment. So you have to catch up. It's not like, not with the cost cap now that everybody is on the same level. Everything the others have invested in the years when Williams couldn't, they still have it and we don't. So you have to be, you have to work in a different way, and that it's more difficult than to get the spirit back and say, we can still beat them. And it's not, we will be world champion in a year or two, but there are other teams, they are not that far away, they are not that far ahead, so we can beat them. If we get more efficient, if we get better, if our spirit gets better, if our teamwork gets better and our processes get better, and if the silos go down, then we get in a position that we can move up. And I believe if a team is, or everybody is on the move up, then you say, you don't need to stop there, you can do more. So what's next? What's next? And if you get this mentality and spirit in the team, then you can move up to the very top. Because if you come from the very down, if you can go to 8, 7, 6, then you have that dynamic that you can really get even better.
But a survival mentality, though, Josh, often means that people become short-term, they become reactive, they become cynical in lots of ways. So how did you get them to start being long-term optimistic and to have this can-do attitude then? Can you give us some tangible examples?
What I have to do is to, again, give the people the message and see how good feels. How it feels if you're good. So how I felt when I was good, when we went the Volkswagen, the World Rally Championship, that feels good. And get also in the team what the experience they had, what feels good. Yeah, and then say, yeah, we want all to feel good again. So then we push. And that's why the first points last year were so important, because it was like, oh, we can't get points anyhow. So now we can get points. And then we got the points. Then we believed in that. And then we got the podium, where nobody believed we could get the podium. And, you know, it was different circumstances, of course, but, you know, you take it if you get it. And for the team to get the podium last year was, wow, yeah, we can do it and it can happen. And this kind of what good feels, then I think everybody wants to feel more of feeling good. If you spread that through the team, that's quite important. But that has to be spread then to the home team as well. It's not just the couple of people who are on the track. So what we did after the points, we did big banners on Monday morning at the entry. And we said the points and thank you very much for hard work. So that everybody who comes in on the Monday sees we were successful, we got the points, and everybody who comes in the factory has its part. And I think that's quite important, that everybody feels we can't win if not everybody is doing a brilliant job and everybody is needed.
And what did you do to celebrate the podium that you got?
We couldn't really celebrate because of COVID, isn't it?
Yeah, I suppose that's the problem, isn't it? But what did you do to the team then to sort of to drive home the fact that that was the first podium this team had in such a long time?
Yeah, but we couldn't do anything because everybody was out. Huh? We couldn't do a lot. And it was also in the middle of the season. Huh? It was the first race of a triple header. And it was COVID. And so it was quite difficult. And we couldn't do events. Yeah, the first time we had this spring, we had the first time we had a town hall where everybody could come in person. Everything else had to be on Teams. So now for this year, we will have a family event in September where every employee they come with 5 people, so they can bring friends. They have an open door, they can show where they work. And we are also planning for the first time again after COVID, like we have a Christmas party. So I think that even if we do not have a podium to celebrate or anything, but we have to bring the team together. And you have to acknowledge if you have good results. Yeah.
Let's talk about you personally. So you come into the team, you speak to your managers, they give you some feedback, but then you've got to try and work out for yourself as well what the problems are. Did you see problems that were different to the ones that were pointed out to you? And if you did, what did you identify as the single biggest problem from your perspective?
See, when what was pointed out by the managers, then you have to, this was, if you do this in half an hour meeting, you don't get to the details. But then, of course, I had to follow up the main thing when I categorized them and see what is the, what causes those issues. Yeah. For example, we didn't have a proper project management, and that caused a lot of frustration because there was the planning was suffering then. Yeah, and it was like production says design is too late, design says error is too late, and design and error says production is too slow. So if you don't have that clear, visible planning and project management, of course, then you create this kind of silos. Yeah, and so that had to be done. And then also bringing different whatever organizational changes that had to be done to become more efficient. Especially now when you see Formula One has the cost cap, it's all about efficiency. So it's how much you can do with the money you're allowed to spend. And that means you have to work in all areas on the efficiency. And it's not that simple as it sounds.
What about self-doubt? Because this is, as we know, a very famous team. It's on the global stage. Lots of people care about the results. Millions of people watch the Grand Prix. Did you have any self-doubt? Or any imposter syndrome or any fear when you walked in here about whether you could turn this team around?
No, never.
Really?
No, never, no. No, but maybe that sounds arrogant, but it is not. I was just going to retire, just had retired when I got the call from Dorilden. For me, I would not have taken any other job in the world. Any other job in the automotive industry or in racing. You know, I'm Formula One, following Formula One fans since I can think. It was in the early 60s, I went with my father to the Grand Prix on the Nürburgring, where still was the paddock in the old paddock, and we could go to the Ferraris and touch them, and it was all open. So I'm Formula One fan since then, and I never ever thought I would be in the position to run Formula One team. That was so far out of reach, isn't it? Because that was impossible. And then, you know, when I was approached by Ron Dennis to the McLaren, that was a huge honor for me. And then unfortunately Ron left, and with that it didn't work to stay there. And then people said, you have something open in Formula One. I said, no, I learned so much from Ron in that time. I really enjoyed it and was happy that I've done it. And I didn't come to Williams to say I have to, you know, to... For me, doing something, isn't it? It's just having the honor to run Williams and to get Williams back from the lowest point they ever been. Like, that's the only challenge that I was willing to accept. And I know it's difficult. It's not. It sounds like a fancy job, but it's a really hardworking job.
But I was really taken by that description you said about being a young boy and going to your first Formula Ones with your dad. And I like that, almost that wide-eyed innocence. Now, having sort of come into the world and experienced some of the harsh realities of it, how have you managed to retain that kind of naivety or enthusiasm for it without becoming cynical or hard-bitten by some of your own experiences?
I think the main thing is that, well, I say that I'm highly competitive. Yeah, but it had to be the area. It's cool to be the best in math. That was not my thing, is that? I didn't want to be the best in math, but I started racing on my 16th birthday, and that's, I wanted to be competitive in racing. And then when I started in the industry and started developing cars, high performance cars, I wanted these cars to be the best high performing cars. And even against the highest competition, you know, when I was at Ford, I got in charge of all the STs and RS models. And I'm still very proud of these. And when I was in Ford in the US, I wanted the Raptor to be the best off-road SUV that's also on the road. It had to be the best. And we did the Shelby GT500. It had to be the best performance car in the US. And then if I go racing, I want to be the best. And that doesn't mean you can only get satisfaction when you win. You can get satisfaction if you move forward and you move towards your objective. Yeah, coming to Williams, I know that's not a 2-3 year work to get it back to the top. It's a 5-10 years work. But as long as you see you can move forward and you can move the team forward and you get better, that gives me the satisfaction to work hard every single day.
And where did this relentless determination to be the best come from?
You know, it came very much when I started racing. And when I came second, my father didn't talk to me for the week because he said, "You put shame on the family name."
And as a joke, or was he being serious?
No, I was serious. He didn't talk to me for a week when I came second. And I didn't have at that time the best material, most likely. So my father, he had the company, he supported other race drivers. They got new tires from him for every weekend. I did get new tires for every second weekend, but I was competing against them. So I had to then to turn the tires around on the rim for the second race that they were still good enough. But I had to beat all them. And already from, I think before I had the first race, I had a piece always on my desk that said, second is the first loser. And wow. For me, it's painful not winning.
So take us into that moment then. So you're 16, you're racing, you've come second, and then you come off and your dad's just blanking you. How did you process that?
I think first you have to love that racing to continue. Yeah, I think many would say, okay, then I don't go racing anymore, forget it. Then I don't get these hard times, isn't it? And so first you have to really love what you do. If you really love what you do, I think then I didn't feel good when I came second as well. So I think I got to the stage that I felt, yes, I put shame on the family name. So it's absolutely right.
You believe what
it
he said to you?
It made that believe me, yes. And then having this thing for me that was not given to me, I put it on there, the second is the first loser. I think then you feel physically bad if you're not winning.
So what do you think your dad was trying to achieve at this point?
I think my dad was highly competitive as well. He wanted to be the best in ever. When we went then to the Dakar together, so I won in 85 the truck category with him in a Unimog. And it was clear when we prepared for that, he was very clear to all of us, we're not going there to finish, we're going there to win. And we were the private team. There were 5, 6, 7 truck factory teams. He said, we are not going there to finish. We are going there to win. And it was so adamant and pushed it into everybody that there was no other way. We have to win. And then we won in 85. We won the truck category with just 2 trucks and 4 people against all the big factory teams. I think if the attitude is it's nice to win, you never win. I think you have to have, there is no other option. We have to win, finally. It's not like every race or every day, but we have to win, finally. If that's not the objective for everybody, then we'll never get there.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than 1 billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey everyone, I just want to talk to you very briefly about what I believe to be a total revolution in sleep, and it's called 8Sleep. It's a pod cover that goes on the mattress that's currently on your bed, and it controls the temperature to suit you perfectly. And it all works from this app. Me and my wife, we like different temperatures. I actually like my side of the bed cooler. But the 8Sleep isn't just about the temperature. It's your own personal sleep coach. I get a sleep fitness score. I can find out more about the quality of my sleep, the kind of routine that I'm in. But it also gives me the different sleep stages as well, so I can find out how much REM sleep or deep sleep I'm getting. And then I can tailor things in my own life, like alcohol or coffee before bed or when I work out, to try and improve my sleep. And we all know that sleep is the foundation of high performance. If we can improve our sleep, we can improve so much of our life. It's time to bring tech to the bedroom by going to 8sleep.com/HPP, where you can get £200 off your pod and free shipping. That's 8sleep.com/HPP.
Today's show is brought to you in association with Mindlift, the most personalized brain training app that can help improve your focus and your relaxation. So Mindlift is neuroscience based. And what I love about Mindlift, I've been using it for a while now, is that it's totally personalized to me. So if you're interested in optimizing your health, I would recommend you check out Mindlift. And don't just take my word for it. Take the word of the elite athletes and the industry leaders who use it. So Mindlift accesses brain sensing technology, games and videos that correspond to your brain's activity. Honestly, it's fascinating. You wear a smart headband which measures your brain activity and gets you a personalized routine to sharpen your mental fitness. I've been using it first thing in the morning, and genuinely, when I go into early meetings or I've got lots happening in a day, I notice the difference. I'd love you to start your personalized program at mindlift.com/high performance, and you will get $40 off your first subscription. That's mindlift.com/high performance.
And this relentlessness has led to you living a life of success, winning world titles, winning trophies, but nothing comes for free. So would you mind sharing, particularly for some of the younger people listening to this, the cost of living a life of being relentlessly, constantly driven to find victory?
I think first of all, you have to find what you really love to do. And then what you really love to do, if it is racing, if it is math, whatever it is, you have to find what you really love to do. And what you really love to do, then you say, if you know what you love to do, you want to be best in that, yeah, because you love it, and then you want to be better than others, and you learn, and you have to be relentless learning, try to get better. But if you love that, then you want to get better. I think you have to be self-driven. You will never achieve if somebody else has to drive you. You have to become self-driven. And then you have to do a lot of compromises in your life as well. If it is family life, if it is partying, you have to do a lot of compromises. And I say, for me, I have so high respect for every Olympics. Yeah, who does it all 4 years and pushes 4 years relentlessly every single day for this one day in 4 years and sets everything beside. Yeah, and you know that if you go for any competition there, only one can get the gold medal out of many. So the chance to be the best is quite low, and still having this vision and go there every single day, work very hard for 4 years, not having any family life, not partying, not nothing, just for this one day to achieve the very best. That's, for me, is the highest level of performance.
And what's been the cost to you personally for living a life like this?
I had to move a lot, yeah, couldn't look after my kids as much as I should have or done. But think on the other side, they benefited from that as well, moving around and having opportunities that maybe they wouldn't have had if we would have stayed in one place. But it's important to always love what you are doing. That's important. Only then you can do a proper job.
So as a father yourself with a son and a daughter, how much have you passed on that mindset of having to be the best and being and placing such demands on yourself to them as your children?
I think that's then comes in the family, isn't it? And if they see that is how the family life is, and what you sacrifice or what the father sacrifice for these results. So when was it Ford in rallying and the kids were small, every time we won, they got the present. So every time I win the rally, because I was away for that, and I said, but if I'm away and win a rally, then you get a present.
And if you lost?
If we lost, was nothing. No, of course not. So, and then they were really supporting and were looking forward to that we won the rally.
Sure.
We won the races. So, and then they went into their sport, Yeah, the son was from 3 years. He wants to play soccer, and he is really adamant. He wants to become a professional soccer player, and he works hard for that. And my daughter went into ice skating, and she did into synchro ice skating, which I think is a very nice sport. It's, you need a lot of discipline.
But if they lost, would you ignore them similar to the way your father did?
No,
you?
No, that's what I learned from them. So I did it a different way. So I encourage them that they know that they want to win, but it's if you lose, you just have to work harder and you can get, and you have to get better. So I did it a different way because I didn't think the way I experienced it was the right way.
And do you think that they've been inspired to do what they've done from seeing you and your work ethic and your relentless drive?
Well, I never asked them, but I think that comes natural then. Isn't it? And they have been part of, I developed the cars, the performance cars I was involved in, and I took these home and was proud about it and told them what we have done. And then it's very similar to racing as well, isn't it? So I think they have seen that it's, yeah, you get something out of winning.
But we've gone through a brilliant story of starting out asking for drivers' autographs, loving motorsport in that respect, getting all the way through to running a Formula One team. Was the hardest period in all of that when you had that very short spell at McLaren? And would you mind sharing with our listeners here what you learned from a period where you made a decision that didn't work out?
I wouldn't say it didn't work out at McLaren. You know, I had quite long negotiations with Ron, to met him, we got closer, and I think I learned a lot from him, and I highly respected him as long as I was aware that he was running McLaren, but it's a very long time. And his achievements were absolutely fantastic. And he said that he chose me to run the team was for me a huge honor. And we had long discussions. And then even the couple of months we worked together, where I would not want to miss that. And I don't think I would be as good in the job now without that.
What did it teach you then that you take now into this job?
You know, we didn't have always the same opinion, but we could have a proper discussion and see where it comes from. He was quite very extreme. And what I learned from him is really the discipline. Yeah, I also learned from him things you might not do that as you should do. But
like what, for example?
For example, in the engineering office, they were not allowed to have a coffee, because it could damage the floor.
Right.
So we could, okay, yes, we'll be careful, but we can free that up a bit.
You have to trust people as well, don't you?
Yeah. And I was highly impressed by Ron, how he built the company, how he ran the company, and what the discipline and how he approached people and how he could motivate people. That was highly impressive.
I'm interested to just pick up on that point, how Ron Dennis motivated people. I mean, he's a legendary figure in Formula One, as you say, achieved incredible success. What was your takeaway from how he motivated people?
I think first of all, as the personality he is also highly competitive. Yeah, absolutely highly competitive. And for him, winning is everything as well. And they has to win. So I think with that, he could motivate the people. He was loved by his employees. He was also good fun. He was quite humorous as well when it was the right time for that. And I think he got the people behind him. The people wanted to work for Ron. Yeah. And this is very much the same here. The people wanted to work for Frank. And this is why, you know, we say we still all work for Frank, even if he is not around. We work for him. And for one example is we have the radios at the track where the neighbors are with a name and the headset. There is a radio and a headset, and there is Frank's name under this, and we keep that. So for us, he is around. We still all work for Frank.
That's lovely.
Oh, I love that.
That's really nice.
And what is it about Frank, if we use him as an example of it, that still ripples down through the generations? What were those qualities that people are so keen to hold on to?
I think it's very much similar to Ron. They were different characters, but I think basically it's the same. Frank was adamant to win. He worked hard. He dedicated his whole life to win in Formula One and to be successful. And even after his accident, where lots of people would have given up their dreams, he continued. And the best and the successful era came even after that. Yeah, and how he showed the dedication. He lived in the factory. He was around all the time. And I think he was also a very nice boss, and he could motivate the people. And I think these attitudes we have to continue.
See, what intrigues me about whether it's Ron or Frank or even talking to yourself, that like the dedication required, this singular focus on victory is essential. But there's also an element of being well-rounded, about being able to engage with people, to be emotionally intelligent, to do those skip-level meetings and just listen to people. How do you develop that side of your personality while still being singularly focused on being the best and winning?
I think first I have to make clear I don't see myself in the same category or level as Frank or Ron. Yeah, by far not. I think they are so much more superior. So I don't see me in that level.
Okay. Yeah. Well, that was my interpretation.
They created something. They grew it up, and I just went into McLaren when it was all built up, and I came here when it is built up. So that's a complete different category, and I think that's a level I will never achieve, and I can't achieve. That's for sure. But you have to be, I think you have to be down to earth. You have to done lots of jobs before when that you appreciate every single job in the company. Yeah. And I did a good lesson was there at the Paris-Dakar when we were with four guys, my brother, my father, a friend of us, and with two trucks, and we had to do everything ourselves. So we had to be the mechanic, the navigator, the driver, the chef, the organizer. We had to do all the paperwork. We had to find the sponsorship. We had to do everything ourselves. And we even had to clean the workshops, and we had to clean the trucks. And then you appreciate, if you have done all these jobs, you know that all jobs have to have be done by dedication, whatever the job is. I think if you are then in the position that you have done that, then I think the people feel that you appreciate the job and that you have been in the same situation, that you have done that. And I think you have, if you're a good leader, you have no job has to be too bad, too tough for you. You have to be able to do everything.
Let's talk then about making tough decisions as a leader. And again, I think this is really valuable for our listeners. You know, this has been a wholly positive conversation about coming in, identifying problems, helping to solve those problems, getting the team back to points, back to a podium, moving it forwards. But there's no question that you can do that without making some really hard decisions. When I say that, what decision does your brain take you to when I ask you about the toughest decision you had to take after you came here in charge of Williams? And any advice you would give to our listeners for how to make those difficult decisions?
I think the toughest decisions is when you find out that a person doesn't fit really to the team.
And you've had to make those decisions?
I had to make those decisions. And especially, I think I like people. So even if you like the people but you say from the whole team dynamic, it doesn't really fit. And then to communicate and to say, come to conclude, it's the best for us if we split ways. Like that is the hardest decision. What when you say from the personality, I don't want to do this. Yeah. But then you have to say what is the best for the team if it doesn't help, if you don't take these decisions and the team doesn't move forward. So that's where I doubt myself a lot, and it takes for me a long time. Is that the right decision? Because it impacts somebody else's life. For me, that is by far the hardest. And then I struggle and I have to be absolutely sure it has to be done.
And how do you make the decision that it's the right thing?
I think that it's talking to other colleagues, analyzing where the issues are coming from, analyzing how the mentality of the team works, and then you might have to do changes. But this is a process for me. I think it takes longer than for other leaders. but I very much care about every single person. So if that has an my decisions have an impact on any person, I have to be, for me, 100,000% sure it's absolutely the right decision for the team and the right decision for this person as well. Because if somebody doesn't get happy the way the team works, then it doesn't work for that person as well. So but that's the hardest decisions to take.
So in following that sort of procedural justice, the idea of these are the gatekeepers I need to pass my decision through, it sounds to me that you think about the team, you think about the individual, and you think about whether that helps you win. If you had to give them a priority, what comes first, second, and third in your decision-making criteria?
I don't think it is a priority. I think it's the whole picture. If you put it all in one part, it's the whole picture. It's not priority one, two, or if priority one, it's fine, then it is a decision. All the three have to be balanced.
The reason I ask is, if I'm working in the engineering department here,
yeah,
and I see that you've made a decision, I'm still 6 months away from a skip level meeting, so I can ask you about that decision.
You're never 6 months away.
Okay, well then, well, a few months. But
not a few months. Not even a few weeks.
But how do I just have the confidence of, I know you've made the decision for the right reasons? Like, what's the transparency of that process?
Now, we have the town halls we have where we explain what we are doing and how we are doing things. And I think if you develop, if these decisions are right, then these decisions do not come just out of my mind. These decisions come based on what I experience within the team. So if the team doesn't feel or see that the decision is right, then it wouldn't be the right decision.
Before we move on to our quickfire questions, there's an area I just want to touch on because we haven't even spoken about it yet, which is dealing with drivers. How you allow these individuals who, let's be honest, in their minds are working in an individual way for themselves, how you allow them to thrive in a team environment. It's quite a challenge, but of course, you're in a unique position where you're now the leader, but you've been the driver. How do you get the best out of them?
I think it's important if you're in charge of drivers, it's important that you have been a driver yourself, that you understand the emotions that the driver has during a race and where it goes through. I think you have to always support the confidence of a driver. You can still push and you can set your expectations. I think the expectations have to be clear and the expectations have to be realistic. Yeah. And then giving them the support and making it very clear that the drivers are, that everybody works for the drivers. When I started at Volkswagen and rallying, and I came in and I went to the test just when I started from the first days, and I met Sébastien Ogier for the first time, and we were on the test. And, you know, we had the plan, the official plan was, it was in 12, in 13, to get competitive, to have a couple of podiums maybe to the end of the year, in 14 to have a couple of wins at the end of the year, and in 15 fight for the championship. And I asked Seb, you know, the plan that we have, and I said, do you really want to be world champion in 15, not earlier? And he said, of course earlier. I said, yeah, me too, but we don't communicate that. Yeah. So you and me, we want to be world champion earlier. We don't want to wait to 15. But I said, this is your team. All the people work for you. And you have to make sure that they love you, that they want to work for you, that they give the very best for you, that they work very hard for you, and that they are happy and proud if you win, because they work for you. They don't work for me, they work for you. And that created this relationship that he understood that if he wants to be world champion, he needs every single member in the team working extremely hard for him to win. And that is where the race drivers, they have a really big ego, and they have to have. If they wouldn't have that, then they would never get on the top of any sport. They have to drive the team, that the team loves him and supports him and gives the, everybody gives the very best for him to win. And then we won the championship in 13.
That's interesting, because when you said the team works for him, I was kind of thinking, well, how do you communicate that to the people here? But actually what you're saying is, by telling the driver the team works for you and you work for the team, you're putting real responsibility on their shoulders to take the team with them, not just to drive the car, but to be a leader within this team.
Exactly. I say every employee wants the drivers to see winning. Yeah, they don't work for me. They work for the drivers, because they are on TV. They are shown. They are sitting in the car. They have to deliver. Every single part that we produce here is the driver to make it successful. So it's pretty clear. If the driver is this halo and the guy everybody wants to work for, then you can be successful.
Interesting, because often, you know, people talk about not putting one person in a business on a pedestal, but that's actually a real valuable way of putting someone on a pedestal, isn't it? Can I ask you how you dealt with the issues that came Nicola Latifi's way after the accident that ended up changing the world title, and it meant that Max Verstappen won it? You know, he was getting death threats. He was across all social media, horrible comments coming his way. Would you mind taking us inside the team at that point and how you protected him and worked with him through that period?
We had to give him the confidence. Yeah, and we said that there was nothing wrong, everything was fine. But it's very difficult to help them, because that was in the end of the season. They all went on vacation. They said they have to take the time off. So he was not around here every single day. And I think it's also, we didn't interfere there too much, as we knew what was happening. We knew what was going on, that he switched his social media off. But if we would have interfered too much, I think we would have made the situation even worse. But that's something everybody has to get over himself. But he was fully aware that he had our backing, that we're absolutely convinced he didn't do anything wrong. Yeah, the crash is, of course, it's shouldn't have happened. But if you're racing, you know crash can happen. And we never blame a driver for that it's possible to crash, right? Because otherwise you have to stay at home if you don't want to crash. But that's to really give him the backing, that he knew the team is behind him. We don't need to talk every day, but the team is behind him and supports him. I think that was and that needs a general, let's say, relationship to me or the sporting director to the driver, so that we don't have to talk to understand each other, isn't it? He knows what we feel for him, and we know how he feels, and he knows that.
And how hard was it for him?
It was extremely hard. I think that's hard for absolutely everybody. And I think everybody who didn't go through this has no idea how that feels. So even if you switch then your social media off, you are in contact with other people who still see it, and you know it's going on, and you just can't get away. And I think that was also a part why it took him quite a while in the season to find his competitiveness. And it's,
so you think it did affect his driving after that?
I'm sure it affected his driving after that. And it would have affected my driving a lot. I'm absolutely convinced about this. So I can understand that. And this is why we gave him the confidence and supported him all the season. And we knew he would come back.
So now's the time for the quickfire round, Josh. So this is where we ask you a series of quickfire questions. And the first one is, what are the three non-negotiable behaviours that you and everyone around you has to buy into?
I think it's honesty, loyalty, and dedication.
Very good. What is your biggest weakness, and what is your greatest strength?
I think my biggest weakness is that I'm not patient, and I think that's my biggest strength as well.
Get stuff done.
So what's been the biggest failure you've experienced, and more importantly, how did you respond to that?
The biggest failure?
Are you going to tell us you haven't had one?
For sure, I had so many that I don't have one. What is the biggest? I think one big failure was when my first race on my 16th birthday, I came last in my category. And that gave me, okay, you have to work harder and not giving up. I think that is, if you have failure, that's in German, you say, you know, get up, shake the dust off, put the crown right and move on. I think that is that's, you learn more from failures than you learn from successes. And that is, I think that's very important. And if you're dedicated, never give up, get up and do it again. And everybody who is successful failed a lot of times before.
What one book would you recommend to our audience?
I think the book that I read and think during school, and that I think that I never forget, read a couple of times, and I think shaped my life, is The Old Man and the Sea from Hemingway. Yeah.
How has it shaped your life?
I think that was also, he was on his own. He got this big whale and he fought with it. Finally, he fell in love with a big fish, and then when he got it to the shores, it was eaten. So I think that is, he wanted, there was the fight, but the fight turned into a love story, and finally it was not the happy end, and I think he was still satisfied. And that it's to fight, and then it's also that the competition is not enemies, it's competitors, and you can like and love your competitors and still want to beat them. I think that is is an excellent lesson, and that's what I learned from that. And also when he came to the shores, then he was on his own. There was not a big celebration, or he did it for himself. And I had this a couple of times when we won the Dakar, then the whole team went back to Frankfurt for a big celebration, and at the airport and coming, I flew straight back to Munich because I didn't want to be part of that. It was just for me the feeling to have that. When I was a team manager at Porsche and we won Le Mans in 94, when the car finished, went through the finish line, everybody celebrated. I locked myself in my office in the truck, cried for half an hour before I could get out. Right. So it's... What I did not have is that I always felt it a couple of seconds inside myself when there is a success, but I didn't have to shout that out or be vocal or anything about it. So it just was for myself.
And finally, do you have one final message for our listeners of your golden rule for living a high performance life?
It's stay human, be highly empathic, have your objectives, and follow your dreams.
Damien.
Jake.
You know, I think we've seen an interesting Jos Capito there, because I think if we spoke to the guy in his 20s who was racing cars and winning titles, and even maybe when he was winning three, you know, WRC world championships, I think we would have seen someone who didn't have almost the freedom that he brought to this conversation. You know, I think the fact that he retired and kind of was happy, was complete in himself, and then came back, means he's not bringing his own ego to this job.
I think that's a really smart point, Jake, that you're making. I think the fact that he said that I've got nothing to prove here, so that almost becomes liberating for you when you see about giving back, you see about helping others, you see about trying to point to people and say to them, you're good, and let me show you why you're good, and you've got that experience to be able to do it. That almost becomes a servant leader, which is what I've very much got the sense of him. You know, like when we made that comment about Ron or Frank, and he was quick to point out that I'm nothing like them. There was a real humility there, that he saw himself as a servant of his team rather than being the head of it.
But do you think that then, because, you know, he said to us, didn't he, which was pretty shocking, that his dad, when he came second in a race, his dad wouldn't speak to him for a week when he was a 16-year-old. And then he got that sort of thing and engraved it on his own desk, that second is the first loser. I find it hard to marry that up with him being happy at a team that is regularly losing. So do you think it's because all of that was about him and now this isn't about him?
Yeah, I think there's something there, because the significant part for me was that he didn't take those same lessons that his dad had applied to him and do it to his own children. So I think whilst he might have accepted it in relation to him and he was willing to make that sacrifice and put himself under that inordinate stress of believing that he had to win or he wasn't worth engaging with, that's not what he does with his children, and it's not what he's doing with his own drivers and his own team. So I think there is something in that, that maybe individually he was prepared to take on that stress, but he recognises how unhealthy that would be to apply that to others.
Yeah, I thought it was really interesting. And also it's a reminder to put empathy above opinion, because we can all look at it and go, how has he not suddenly turned that team around? Why aren't they winning races? Yet he comes and tells us that for the first few months, he never even saw anybody. Like, change a culture at a team, yeah, turn a losing team into a winning team, but you can't meet anyone because of COVID.
Yeah, exactly. So, but again, I think that's a really important lesson for anyone to hear this, that don't get caught up on just looking at results and assuming that if you come in last, you're bad. I think looking at it in terms of what's going on there, what's the process? Are they improving? What are the measures that they're doing it? And then when you understand the context of it, actually making improvements is going to be a far more significant measure of just impact than whether they're coming on a podium or not.
We had a really nice message from a gentleman called Andy, who said, I want to speak to you about two people who are co-founders of a business called Financial, a female-focused app helping women take control of their money. I used to work with them both. They were part of the senior team at Travel Counselors before launching their own tech business last year. And I think they could give you a brilliant perspective for high performance. They talk a lot about males as allies and families taking control of money together, not leaving everything to the woman in terms of practical and mental load, but positioned in an open and inclusive way. I think they'd be a great fit. And they're huge fans of the High Performance Podcast. Well, let's meet Laura. Laura, is all of that true?
It is, and it's alongside my sister Holly, but you've only got one of us today, thankfully.
No worries. Well, I want to start then by talking about how men can be better allies to women.
We kind of position ourselves as lifting the lid to men and women about a lot of gender equalities. And it's just interesting, obviously, the recent success of the women in the Euros and you know, Ian Wright coming out as such a big ally and speaking openly about, you know, what we can all do together. And I think where we see allies in the world of finance is that we all need to come together and work together and recognize some of these differences, but apply practical solutions to them. And so when we often see things like female mentorship programs, and it's females mentoring other females, and it's kind of like, why wouldn't we just be inclusive and get everyone's help to get everyone up to the same level and play as a team? And so we really advocate this kind of role of the male ally, rather than kind of this blame culture of men, which is sometimes seen, or this kind of it's not my problem position. So, yeah.
So where does this come from then, Laura? Where's this drive to want to level the playing field?
The business was an Instagram page before it was an app. And it was built, I guess, on the Northern principle of speaking a bit directly about money. And what we found was speaking directly about money. And actually, we produced a really simple plan that we call the Couch to 5K for Money, which is anyone can start, just like when you're getting off your couch and you're running to the first lamppost. And you just need to learn just enough. You don't need to suddenly go and be a financial advisor. You don't need to be the stock market. But actually, basic money management is something that we're not taught. What we found is the demographic overwhelmingly swung towards females. So when you dig a little bit deeper and you do customer interviews and you get to know your community, it's because females tend to handle the mother load, literally, of unpaid labor around the home, spending decisions, even if they've not, you know, they're not earning the wealth in the family. And we kind of thought that this is just wrong. And I just don't think lots of people know about it. People hear about the gender pay gap. So for those of you with children, the gender pay gap actually starts at 8. So girls get 5% less pocket money than boys on average. And it's just little stats like that, that, you know, my husband's a dad of two girls and every day something shocks him and he wants to do more as well. So I think it was an accidental fall. It wasn't a, you know, a passion from the age of 10 to bring equality together. But here we are.
And how did the podcast help with the decision to leave a business, set up your own business, all of that kind of stuff?
So I remember, and probably my most favourite podcast, but unsurprisingly, was the Sean Wayne episode. I am from Wigan. So yes, and actually he coached my brother-in-law. My brother-in-law played for his academy team for years. And it lifted the lid on how he operated. And I felt he was very inspirational about building a high performance team. And I, at that stage, was kind of running Financial by myself as a hobby. It wasn't a business, but it was this confidence factor of actually you can kind of build a team that can help take this really simple product and take it to lots of people. And it was this, the realization that it'll never hit many people and lives won't be changed if I just try and do it myself. I remember Sean talking about how a coach had made him feel. I think he got dropped and he didn't really know why. And he said, none of my team members will ever be made to feel like that. They'll always know what's expected of them. They'll always know. And if they haven't hit that threshold and I have a meeting with them before the game, they'll know already that they're not on the starting list. And I thought, what, like a brutally honest but empowering way to help your team members and help your staff. And that just stuck with me because I remember thinking, right, now's the time to build a team and to set out what's expected if we're going to go do something really big.
I'm interested about the dynamic of working with your sister as well, Laura, that obviously brings its own challenges and its own benefits. What have you learned around that?
So I poached her, firstly. So poaching her for skill set. She is an amazing worker, hard worker, works in partnerships. So she's worked at Manchester United before. I actually poached her to join Travel Counsellors and set up the partnerships team there, actually. So I knew she had a skill set that I didn't have. And so I was focused on content creation and product building. But, you know, you need revenue and you need sales and you need to be able to monetize what you're doing. And so I think from a very early start, we both had big ambitions for the business. We were never going to leave careers that we enjoyed and that did quite well at just to do something on the side. It was always going to be something scalable. And so, yeah, I kind of signed her in the transfer window and got her that way. And then since then, you know, we moved very quickly because we're sisters from Wigan. So we've had all the arguments there is to have about this, that, and the other. We know our skill sets. We know kind of how to hold each other accountable. And yeah, you find lots of family businesses, even in the tech world, come out a little bit. And I think it's because you can just move so quick.
Great. And finally, what would you say is your biggest learning from the podcast that you'd like to leave our listeners thinking about?
I think, especially from a female perspective, it's this feeling that you don't have to be perfect, especially when you start. And so I think females tend to want to do something perfectly or not at all. And I found the podcast a little bit like The Wizard of Oz and lifting up the curtain, and that actually underneath most perfect or what seemingly perfect performances is actually a lot of scrappiness, a lot of mistakes, a lot of real humans behind the curtain. And I think that's an
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Inspiration, because I think it's so easy to look at someone really successful and think, well, that's because of genes or it's because of circumstance or I'm just never going to be able to do that. So definitely the lifting the lid and lifting the curtain and seeing what's behind all these, you know, high performing people, just every new episode I find something new.
So there you go. As always, big thanks to you for growing and sharing this podcast. Listen, I just ask you to do one thing. Please rate and review this podcast if you enjoyed it. Wherever you get your podcasts from, it takes you about 20 seconds, but it makes a huge difference to us. Don't forget you can join our free members club, the High Performance Circle. Just go to thehighperformancepodcast.com. You'll get all the details there about things that we're planning. And finally, thanks to the whole team of Finn, Hannah, Will, Eve and Gemma. Remember, there is no secret. It is all there for you. So chase world-class basics. Don't get high on your own supply. Remain humble, curious and empathetic. And we'll see you very soon.